This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk. Concentrated equity market leadership, rising geopolitical risk, uncertainty about the effectiveness of bonds as a source of decorrelated returns. It's not difficult to grasp why diversification, while it doesn't provide a guarantee against loss in a declining market, is increasingly sought after by investors. My name's Harry Brooks. I'm a content manager here at L&G, and today I'm joined by three investment specialists who are about to publish their second quarter outlook. In this publication, they examine three very different approaches to diversification. Eli Piscopiello, you're a senior index and ETF analyst, and in the outlook, you've chosen to focus on dividend income strategies. Can we start by talking about why targeting dividend payments might help to increase diversification?
Hello, Harry, and thanks for having me today. There are a couple of reasons why targeting dividend payments can increase diversification. The first one is to reduce exposure to stock market volatility. As you know, dividends can act as a potential buffer when markets are volatile, and they get paid in all market cycles most of the time. And so having a dividend cash flow itself can be a diversifier of the income stream component. So on one side, you would have the fluctuation of the share price, and then on the other side, you will have this more stable dividend, this cash flow in any market cycle. Modern strategies can help investors target regular, stable income for predictability and liquidity management, for example, by trying to smooth those payouts throughout the year in a more stable type of manner. So this is the first reason, so reducing that exposure to stock market volatility. And then the second reason is basically companies that can pay dividends are inherently more stable, generally speaking, because in order to sustain this payout month over month, quarter over quarter, you need to be a company with good financial health and strong discipline to be able to sustain this income. So yeah, these are the two main reasons.
Thanks, Ellie. So I mentioned equity market concentration at the start of the podcast. One of the ways this shows up is the technology sector, of course, accounting for a very big slice of market cap weighted equity indices. How does a dividend-focused strategy change that picture?
A dividend strategy, an income strategy, can increase sector diversification, of course, because it increases exposure to cheaper parts of the market. And actually, this is not only true from a sector perspective, but also from a geographical perspective. Now, it depends on the underlying strategies, but with regards to sector, for example, companies that can pay dividends and sustain dividends tend to be more mature than other companies that are focused on growth. As an example, you can think about financials, utilities, or industrials companies more mature than others that tend to spend less capex for aggressive growth targets and rather use that extra cash to pay more out to investors. And so from a sector perspective, this means more financials, utilities, generally industrials, and less exposure to IT, where, as you said, we are seeing a lot of concentration. And then I mentioned the geographical exposure as well. So, of course, if we think about less IT, more industrials, these strategies can have a tilt away from the US, which is a high growth, high technology type of geographical exposure, and perhaps moving from the US to other regions like Japan or Europe, where, again, we find more financials or industrial, for example. And as an outcome, actually, this type of tilt can result in a strategy that can have lower PE, so even more attractive from a valuation standpoint at the overall level, but also looking within each sector. If we compare an income strategy to a traditional market cap exposure, even within the sectors, we can find really pockets with lower valuations.
Of course, every investment strategy has potential pitfalls as well as potential advantages. One that's well known and relevant here is what's called the dividend trap. Can you explain really briefly what that is and how investors might try to avoid it?
Sure. A dividend trap can happen when companies are paying out so much dividends, so high, very high dividends, that are actually sacrificing capital growth or reinvestment of their profits into growth opportunities just to pay out that cash. And also, on the other hand, having a high dividend yield, so that's the dividend over the price of a company, that can happen if the price is, the denominator basically is too low. And that can mean that the share price has fallen because of fundamental reasons. So the company may not be doing very well. So when we have a dividend trap, we're having either a non-sustainable, too high dividend payment or a dividend yield that is a symptom of some share price issues. And what do we do to avoid a dividend trap? One way for sure is to apply a quality overlay. So to make sure that the companies that we identify in the portfolio can pay out dividends in a sustainable way and that companies are profitable as well. And another way to mitigate this risk is equally weighting companies or with some liquidity adjustments. But when we have an equal weighting, of course, we have less concentration, so less risk to fall in a dividend trap. So we mitigate that risk of having a big, big holding in a company that's paying too much for the wrong reasons. And of course, equal weighting, going back to your previous question as well, helps from a valuation perspective because it also allows to reduce that concentration in expensive names.
Thanks, Ellie, for that quick fire guide to dividend income. You touched there a couple of times on equal weighting and how this can aim to improve diversification. Aud Martin is our head of pooled index investment specialist. For her article, she delved deeper into that topic of equal weighting. Aud, welcome to the podcast. Can you start by giving us a bit of background here? How concentrated are equity market indices today, and what has this meant for investors?
Thanks a lot for having me on the podcast today, Harry. Yes, I mean, if we speak of concentration, and this is actually a topic that we've been speaking about at LNG for now over 2 years, and that concentration risk comes from really the mega caps company when we look at market capitalization indices. So if we take a bit of a step back and look at, for example, the traditional US market cap indices, looking at just the top holdings, so the top 10 or the top 5, what we've seen over the past couple years now is that you have those top holdings that, you know, can make up 38%, over 35% on average in the US, for example, for US indices of this portfolio and of the total weight. If you look at the top five also of those companies, it's, you know, at around 15%+. So that's really a lot of emphasis that is being made onto those top names. And if you compare that to 5 years ago, the top 10 holdings was not above 26%. So we've seen definitely an increase. And in terms of, you know, why those weights have increased as part of those market capitalization weighted indices, it's because of the growth that those mega caps have been capturing. So yes, there's been a lot of opportunities. We've heard a lot of artificial intelligence, a lot of technology developments, but this definitely comes at the cost of diversification. What it means for investors when they are invested in those, I would say, standard market cap weighted indices and portfolio is that they are heavily skewed towards IT as a sector. So it exposed them to the risk of perhaps a large drawdowns in the case that sentiment turns against the sector. And we're coming into an era, actually, since the beginning of this year, where we see other segments that are, you know, outside IT, information technology, that are starting to capture some growth. And those investors might want to take part in that and in those other segments of the market. This is why we see value in investment strategies outside market cap weighted indices. And, you know, having other weighting schemes, having an equal weighted portfolio can mitigate those risks. And this is one thing to consider for an investor.
So if an investor does choose an equally weighted index rather than a market cap weighted index, what's the effect in a bit more detail on the number of companies that they will gain meaningful exposure to?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it changes really your true exposure that you get and you gain access to as an investor. So if you take it a bit of a step back again and look at the market cap weighted portfolio and an equal weighted portfolio. You know, when you have an equal weighted portfolio, those weights are smoothed out and evenly distributed across all the holdings. And it's rebalanced either on a quarterly basis or semi-annual basis, usually, depending on if you're looking at a core exposure or thematic exposure. So your real exposure, so really the real exposure that you gain access to, it can go up to 99% of your your whole portfolio, as opposed to only 10% on average when you shift away, you know, looking at just a market cap weighted portfolio. And so coming back to what we're saying earlier, having that market cap weighted concentration in a handful of companies. So usually it's going to be 10% of the portfolio. So if you think about it, sometimes it's even about 5-10 companies. So really those top that are, you know, contributing to performance, yes, but also contributing to risks. You know, this is also the way to think about it. You really shift away from that approach, having that smoothed weight across your entire portfolio. And what's really interesting and important to understand here is that your equal weighted performance, it comes from the exact same source of underlying holdings. So you start with the same universe. It's really just that weighting element that makes a difference in terms of what growth do you capture, where do you capture it from, and what are the underlying assets that you really get exposure to. Again, in case of a drawdown, you have the benefits of maybe not only being in a single sector or a handful of sectors, but then you really play that, I would say, defensive or cyclical that might be better balanced as part of your portfolio.
That makes sense. Coming back to a couple of points that Ellie touched on earlier on, what impact does equal weighting have in terms of geographical and sectoral diversification?
Yes. So, I mean, in terms of diversification, looking at an equal weighted portfolio, it's exactly the same as, you know, what Eli has described. You have access to further sectors, and in the case of a global, I would say, portfolio, more geographies as well. So if we take, again, real examples here, usually if you look at IT in global indices, it's 25% plus of, I would say, the exposure that you get. And if you look at US, it can go up to 30-35%. So going even more concentrated into IT. On an equal weighted approach, you can really redistribute that weight. So you can almost divide it in half. And then you have, you know, half of that weight that can be redistributed across other sectors. So you really tone down the dial onto your IT. And then what you find more is some financials, healthcare, materials, and industrials, usually. These are the ones that are dialed up. Geographies, I mean, I guess the elephant in the room here is U.S. exposure, really. That is a worry for investors, and they have quite a lot of that in their broader portfolio already. And this is, again, toned down. If you look at a global portfolio, usually U.S. companies, they can make up to 70-75% of, you know, the exposure. Again, a caveat here that we need to have is that most of those companies will have revenues coming globally, you know, across the regions. But again, it is very concentrated into those handful of stocks. It's usually very also correlated to IT as a sector. But if you move away from that market cap weighted, this weight will come down from about 70% to 40%. So what it allows you to have as well is redistributing that weight across Japan, Europe, which are the other areas of the markets that you might want exposure to. And again, you know, you gain exposure to other growth pockets of that broad and global market. So if we speak of a global portfolio, you have a more real exposure to those global portfolios. And, you know, the result of this reallocation of weights is not only diversification, it's also lowering your concentration risk, as we've explained earlier today. But then again, it's also having, you know, access to cheaper valuations. So investors can target sectors that are trading at a cheaper value and capture the potential future upside and growth of those specifically.
Thanks so much, Ord. The final article in our Q2 Outlook, which is coming out in the next couple of weeks, uses quite a different lens to zoom in on the theme of diversification. Shishen Zhao is an ETF thematic research analyst who has examined the interplay of thematic equity strategies and factor exposures. Shishen, for anyone unfamiliar with factors, can you give us a lightning quick summary of what they are and why they matter for investors?
Yeah, thanks, Harry. And really, this is a great question to start with, because factors are the bridge between a long-term thematic trend and how that theme actually behaves as a portfolio. When we talk about factors, we simply mean broad, persistent characteristics that help explain how groups of stocks tend to deliver risk and return over time. And at ONG, we use 5 key factors, namely value, quality, growth, momentum, and low volatility. And each of them gives us a different lens Some tells us about a company's financial strength and resilience, while others reflect market behavior, things like sentiment, pricing trends, or volatility. And now, in thematic investing, this becomes very important. Unlike traditional equity investing, themes aren't built around sectors. They cut across traditional sectors and geographies, which is one reason thematic allocation can offer fresh diversification versus a standard market cap indices. It is key to understand the underlying asset's characteristics. Two themes that sound uncorrelated may behave similarly if they share the similar factor profile. And the opposite is true as well, that two themes with different factor exposures can complement each other very well inside a portfolio. That's where our LNG factor scores come in. They help us look beneath the surface and identify where investors may be gaining useful diversification. Factor scores helps us understand whether a thematic index is driven by companies reinvesting for future growth or by more mature cash-generative business, whether a theme behaves more defensively or whether it's more cyclical. So in short, I think themes tell us what companies do and how they benefit from long-term structural trends. Factor tells us how those companies behave. And when you combine the two, investors get a much clearer picture of what their portfolio is really exposed to and how those exposures could evolve over time. We will explore the link between themes and factors and how this exposure shifts over time in a much more detail in our full research report in later this year.
Great. That was really clear and helpful. So your research, as you say, it looks at how different thematic equity strategies map onto this factor landscape that you've described there. What were your headline findings?
I would say this really is the heart of our research. When we map our thematic indices onto the factor landscape using LNG's factor scores, based on data as of the end of 2025, we start to see different exposures between two groups of themes. On one side, we have the innovation-led themes, such as robotics, AI, clean energy, battery value chain, healthcare technology, and even the metaverse. These themes tend to cluster towards growth and momentum, and it tells us something intuitively that the companies most related to these themes tend to be reinvesting for future expansion. They often sit in earlier stage of a long-term structural trend, and they behave like fast-growing innovators, which is exactly what investors would expect from them. On the other side, we have what we called essential service themes. These include areas like clean water, cybersecurity, e-commerce, and global brand. We classify them as essential service because they provide non-discretionary habit services or platforms that households and businesses rely on day to day. And these themes tend to lean more towards quality, value, and low volatility. That reflects steadier fundamentals, more defensive business nature, and more consistent cash flows. These are the companies where earnings stability and essential demand drive the story. So the headline message is very simple and very important. Thematic investing is not one single style. Different themes carry different factor exposures, and those differences really matter. The growth and momentum tilt of innovation-led themes behaves very differently from the quality and value tilt of essential service themes. And because of that, mixed themes with different factor profiles can offer genuine diversification. In other words, the factor landscape of thematic equity is quite varied, and that variety creates opportunities for investors to combine themes that do not all behave in the same way.
It's such an interesting way of reconsidering the thematic equity landscape through that factor lens. So how might investors make use of these detailed, comprehensive insights that you've created through your research in really practical terms?
Oh, well, so when we look across the thematic universe, one of the really helpful things we have learned is that different themes tend to come with their own distinct and measurable factor exposures. and factors become a very powerful lens for investors to understand what's driving returns inside a thematic portfolio and how that theme is likely to behave across different market environments. That insights can really strengthen portfolio construction decision making. To start with, the first benefit is around setting expectations. If a theme naturally leans towards growth and momentum, it may be more responsive to changes in the market sentiment, but it can also participate strongly when innovation and risk appetite pick up. Meanwhile, if a theme has more quality or low volatility characteristics, it may behave more steadily, offering resilience when markets turn more defensive. So factors help investors allocate with intention because they get a clear sense of what behaviors are likely. The second benefit is around improving portfolio balance. Because each theme carries a different factor shape, investors can combine them deliberately to create more rounded portfolios. For example, an innovation-heavy theme can be complemented with essential service themes that naturally tilt towards quality or value. That combination maintains exposure to long-term growth ideas while also adding stability and reducing cyclicity. And that balance is often what smooths returns through different market regimes. It's also helpful to remember that diversification at a portfolio level comes from different drivers of return, and factors capture those returns. They help explain why a theme leads during growth lead release, why other themes might lead during value rotations, and whether a new theme is adding diversification or reinforcing exposures that investors already have. And this becomes very practical from a portfolio construction standpoint because investors can use factor exposure to make sure a thematic allocation fits comfortably within the portfolio's overall profile to avoid unintentionally concentrating in one factor, add missing or desired factor exposures, and manage volatility and drawdown risks in a more systematic way. So the big takeaway here is that factors enhance the investor's toolkit. They do not replace themes, they support them. By highlighting the underlying drivers of risk and return, factors help investors understand performance cycles, improve diversification, and design portfolios that are better aligned with the outcomes they want to achieve.
Well, thank you so much, Shishen or Danelli, for giving us a sneak preview there of some of the highlights from your Q2 outlook. If you'd like to explore their ideas in more depth, make sure you're registered at blog.lng.com so that you're sent the outlook as soon as it's released. I hope to talk to you again soon on LNG Talks Asset Management. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities, Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc. a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal & General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.